From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The issue of immigration in America has always been the focus of controversy, racist rhetoric, and cruel policies. Indeed, this is by design, as part of a nation whose origin is built on white supremacy. A new book examines how migrant suffering sustains white democracy. In it, author Christina Beltran points out that anti-immigrant practices offer nativist Americans, quote, a legally sanctioned opportunity to impose tyranny over a non-white population while still claiming constitutional protections for themselves, end of quote. Christina Beltran is associate professor at New York University's Department of Social and Cultural Analysis. Her earlier book is The Trouble with Unity, Latino Politics and the Creation of Identity. She joins me to discuss her latest book called Cruelty as Citizenship, How Migrant Suffering Sustains White Democracy. Welcome to the program, Christina.
Thank you for having me.
So this is, of course, an approach to immigration, to examine it as part and parcel of American democracy that has been seen before, because the country has a history of determining which immigrants are legitimate and which ones aren't. And generally, it has been the white immigrants that have been seen as legitimate, or immigrants that have eventually been seen as attaining the status of whiteness. How do you see the past 4 years in particular, the Donald Trump era, as part of that historical trend of cruelty toward those people seen as other in the United States?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think what's been so interesting is that on the one hand, you know, the situation with Donald Trump is simultaneously extraordinary and part of such a long history. So I think one thing you see is that the kinds of assaults on immigrants, particularly immigrants from Latin America, Mexico and the rest of Latin America, have been ongoing. We've seen hostility towards these populations for generations, for decades, you know, since 1848. But we've certainly seen a rise in those things starting in the mid 1990s, where you saw a lot of the sort of rise of people like Steve King and other sorts of senators and elected officials becoming increasingly virulent in their language of immigrants and their hostility towards migrants. And I think that the Trump era sort of became a moment that really highlighted the intensification of that rhetoric. And it also showed a kind of new suturing of sort of the way we want to, or the way that the Trump administration wanted to animate a sense of nativist belonging for white voters or for white citizens, and sort of to reanimate their sense of belonging via sort of more aggressive nativist politics, to give them a sense, in other words, to make their citizenship feel more valuable by denigrating non-white migrants.
Right. So that kind of messaging that Trump came into the political sphere with, I imagine, resonated quite deeply with those Americans who already saw the immigrant as somehow threatening their existence or their citizenship. But did it also not influence more Americans that might not otherwise have felt that way? I mean, we certainly see a much greater percentage of Americans influenced by Trumpism and Trumpist policies after 4 years of a leader relentlessly banging on this drum than we saw in 2016, right? And leaders have the power to deeply influence people's views.
Yeah, definitely. And we saw that. We saw two things happening. I mean, I think one of the things that really interested me about the question of, we've been seeing this rise in nativism over, like I said, especially maybe in the last 20 years, we've seen a particular kind of spike in the sort of anti-immigrant rhetoric in certain places, and particularly within the Republican Party. And that's happened. What's been kind of interesting is that this has happened simultaneously with the fact that if you look at the Gallup polls, that in the last 25 years or so, overall, Americans have become more comfortable with immigration and less nativist in their views. Like if you look at the Gallup polls from 1996, there was more anxiety about immigration than recent polling, which shows a much lower number of people. It was sort of in the highs. It was in the mid 60s in the 1990s. Today, it's around 35%. The numbers of people who think immigrants are a threat or a problem has actually gone down over the last 20 years. So one of the contradictions that we see now is that there's a smaller population of white voters who are more animated by anti-immigrant sentiment, right? So this population has been sort of animated. It kind of reminds me of the gun control debate in the sense that there are fewer Americans now who own guns, but the ones who do own guns have more of them and are more aggressive around gun ownership. So there's this kind of narrowing but intensification. And I think Trump really added to that creation of that intensification on the one hand. And so the demand for the vitriol. And so that was one of the things I was trying to kind of make sense of is how is it that with actually immigration numbers going down since 2015, especially from Mexico, why is this hostility ratcheting up, right? And so on the one hand, you have populations that are, you know, more upset and angry and worked up about immigration. And then you also have a segment of the population that Trumpism has also galvanized, which are Americans who didn't see immigration as a particularly significant issue for them, who have now become more positive towards immigrants. So it's causing this sort of heightened partisanship and this sort of intensified divide between those who have been sort of drawn into Trumpism and find a great deal of meaning and satisfaction in anti-migrant rhetoric and policy, and those who are repulsed by it, and it pushed them away from the Republican Party. So we're sort of seeing a bifurcation. And the other thing I think that's interesting about that break is that after 4 years of Trumpism, we would have thought that Latino voters in particular would be moving further away from the Republican Party. And what 2020 showed was that actually certain segments of Latinx voters and Asian American voters got drawn into Trumpism. And I think that is the other part of this story, which talks about the fact that when we talk about whiteness and white supremacy, we're talking about an ideology of domination. And that ideology of domination can get can draw people in whether they're white or not. So whiteness here is a political color.
Right. So in fact, that was exactly going to be my question. It seems as though that hardcore Trump supporting base is actually less driven by loss of economic power rather than the loss of political power.
Yeah, that is very true. And that was shown, we saw that in the data. I'm a political scientist by training, although I'm a political theorist. So I do democratic theory. I don't do data analysis as much. But one of the things that I talk about in the book is looking at what political scientists have found. And they found that the arguments that Trump voters were drawn to Trump because of economic anxiety was actually, that's been sort of disproven by a lot of the data that in fact, a lot of Trump voters, the thing that made a Trump voter often was anxiety about status, anti-Muslim sentiment and anti-immigrant sentiment. Those voters who showed the highest levels of anxiety around immigration and those voters who showed sort of the highest levels of concern about the loss of white standing, actually, who felt that white people, for example, were being discriminated against. That was the population that was more drawn to Trump. It wasn't just being a white working class voter. It was really about this anxiety about status.
We know that, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the origins of this nation with respect to, you know, being steeped in white supremacy have resulted in ebbs and flows of immigration policy, but generally veered towards cruelty when it comes to immigration. But also, of course, we have simultaneously this cruel history of slavery, the legacy of which continues today. How within your analysis, where does the broader movement for racial justice fit in, particularly when it comes to African Americans?
Yeah, I think that's so key. And it's really something that I wanted to explore in the book, because as I began thinking about, I'm finishing another book right now, actually, that looks at a lot of Latino conservatives. So I'd actually been looking at Latinx conservatives. And then when Trump was elected, I realized I really wanted to understand where conservatism was and where whiteness was as an ideology, because it seemed like it was on the upswing in this way. And in reading that history and really delving into it, one thing I was so struck by that I think we don't think about enough is how slavery and anti-Blackness and Jim Crow was a deeply democratic and participatory politics. And I think we don't think about that so often. So I think, so for example, when we talk about Jim Crow, or the Black codes during slavery, that one of the things, not only was violence and domination and exclusion and violence legally sanctioned, but it was an activity that Americans got to enact in their daily lives, right? So anti-Blackness has been a participatory endeavor. If you lived in the South, for example, or in the Southwest, when it came to Juan Crow against Mexicans, for example, you could, you know, if you were a waitress, if you were a hotel clerk, if you were a bus driver, you could tell people, you could tell Black people where to sit, where to move. You could demand of them, you could police their bodies and make demands on them in terms of where they could occupy public space. You could keep them out of certain parks. And that didn't just happen. We sometimes think of Jim Crow as like the Black and white, you know, drinking fountains as this sort of paradigmatic idea. But what I think is important is that Jim Crow wasn't simply a self-sorting process. It was a process where white citizens got to police Black bodies and take pleasure in that and take pleasure in knowing what spaces could be kept white and what spaces could be kept Black, right? And so I think that that participatory democratic element that made people feel free and it made people feel equal to each other as white citizens is a really important element of why today attacking non-citizens, attacking migrants, is such a compelling space, is that it lets them revisit that earlier practice. It lets them return to a moment where they can invoke the law to exclude people. And after 1964 and 65 with the Voting Rights Acts, you're not really allowed to do that anymore. I mean, people still try, but they're not really legally sanctioned to do that kind of racial violence.
And so now, immigrants of color then offer that foil for whiteness and white democracy to assert its dominance.
It offers that form of release, and it allows them to do it in this legally sanctioned way. And it makes their citizenship feel meaningful in part because of that sort of policing. And I think that that issue of figuring out not only what sort of anxieties do immigrants create for these populations, but I think the thing I wanted to explore were what sort of participatory political pleasures are they getting from not only doing violence to migrants, whether they're acting in militias or as ICE agents, or as even just going to a Trump rally and speaking violence. And then later we saw with the attack on the Capitol, another example where like sort of white mob violence was enacted in this moment that, you know, people sort of had been almost trained to do that at Trump rallies.
Wow. You use the term in your book, herrenfolk democracy. Tell me the origin of that term and why you use it.
Yeah, I was really interested in that idea because it was a term used by a scholar named Pierre de Berg, who was studying, doing a comparative analysis of the US and South Africa and Mexico, I believe. And one of the things, and he uses this term, and the term got sort of picked up by other scholars of whiteness. And one of the points he makes about herrenfolk democracy is he says, it is a practice that is democratic for the master race, but tyrannical for subordinate groups. And that seemed really important to me because what I thought
was, it's a German term, just as a
right, herrenvolk, it's sort of master race. Yeah. So it's sort of it implies a kind of master race. But the idea of the herrenvolk, that it could be democratic for that master race, but tyrannical to others, seemed important to me because I think one of the elements of white democracy, and so I argue that herrenvolk democracy is sort of one iteration of white democracy. White democracy is sort of a larger term because I think white democracy can happen even when it's no longer legally sanctioned. People can, like, you know, under the Trump era, there are certain people trying to enact white democracy even though it's no longer legally sanctioned. Herrenvolk democracy is a particular form of it that is sanctioned under, say, the apartheid era or the apartheid era in the US, right? And I think that that language of it being tyrannical to others, what struck me as important about that is that the people who engage in that kind of politics see themselves as law abiding. In fact, they see the acts of racial domination they do as a form of enacting the rule of law, right? So they don't see themselves as lawbreakers, and they don't, even when they exceed the law, right? Even when they engage in lynchings or other forms of extra legal activity.
Or the January 6th riot on the Capitol.
I mean, people keep saying that during the riot, people were like, what a bunch of idiots. These people weren't wearing masks and they were filming themselves and videotaping themselves. But, you know, based on the kind of historical research of, you know, when you look at the United States and the history of white mob violence, there is nothing unique about that. In fact, that's been more the case. Most of the groups of kind of white, you know, mobs out there often called themselves things like Sons of Liberty. They would engage in a lynching, and then underneath the body, they would write the words justice. Mm. So the fact that they understood themselves as both protected by the rule of law, but themselves also being free to wield the law in these violent ways, they saw themselves as enacting their citizenship. They didn't see themselves as lawless or as doing anything wrong. And I think that's a really important element of the politics of whiteness that we're seeing right now.
So, and I'm not sure if you covered this aspect in your book. So do you then, based on this analysis of yours and the historical framework, does the evolution of the Republican Party to what it is today then in a way make sense?
I think it does completely. I mean, I think the break in the party in 1964, when the party, when Goldwater was nominated, and Goldwater had been opposed to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, that moment, Goldwater lost by a landslide in that election. And then when Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980, a lot of people said, oh, it's sort of the Goldwater moment just took, you know, 16 years to get here. But it actually, you know, came back. It kind of finally made its full emergence. And so I think the Republican Party has, you know, occasionally we've had presidents like the Bushes who have tried for a certain kind of neoliberal multiculturalism and tried to invoke that kind of multicultural conservatism. But on the whole, the party has consistently invested itself in white resentment. And I think it's sort of thought it could control this beast, but it's been playing with white resentment and it has been invoking it and creating the conditions for this for decades now. And so I think that it's not shocking that it finally sort of grew in this way that makes it very difficult for the party to control, is because they have been invested in this idea. And I think, you know, the element that I think we don't think enough about that I tried to write about is that Jim Crowism was a bipartisan affair in the 50s and the 60s. White Southern Democrats, you know, were some of the main, you know, engineers of Jim Crow. White Southern Democrats became Republicans starting in the late 1960s. Like the shift of sort of pro, you know, white grievance politics, that segment of the Democratic Party moved into the Republican Party. And so you have people like Strom Thurmond, who were Democrats, who became Republicans. And so that shift, I think, is telling, because the part of the US political history, the part of this country's legacy of politicians who've been willing to deny people the franchise, to deny people their rights, that's always existed. So we're sort of shocked by this authoritarian turn in Republican politics. It's the authoritarian practice of white democracy. This has been a segment of the US political class that has been consistently invested in denying rights to certain people based on race. So it doesn't surprise me that the party that has cultivated nativism is the part that is rolling back voting rights. And that is, you know, the things that they're engaging in, it used to just be aimed at African Americans. Their authoritarianism is now a more multiracial project, but it is very much, I think, tied to that early history of the denial of liberal constitutional rights for some Americans.
I think that was such an important segue. The issue of who is seen as a legitimate voter, quote unquote, is very much in the news these days, underpinning the Republican push to suppress voting rights. You know, right after the 2020 election began the efforts to not explore how the party could actually better attract voters, but how the party could simply reduce those people who it thinks should vote so that it can win elections and basically become a party of white minority rule. I mean, we see these Republican lawmakers talk about the integrity of voting, which is just essentially code, right, for who has the right to vote and who doesn't, based upon their conservatism and or race, which are, of course, deeply intertwined. It's becoming more and more overt.
Yeah, I mean, it really, what's so interesting is that, you know, we have never had a voter fraud problem in this country ever. We have had a voter turnout problem. And even with the high numbers of people voting in 2020, there are still millions and millions of Americans who don't vote, who are eligible to vote, who don't participate. So we've always had a turnout. That's our democratic challenge, is getting more people to vote. And the fact that these folks want fewer people to vote. And it also speaks to, I think, the thing that you raised, which is this idea that they see themselves, there's a real difference between eligibility and the people who see themselves as the real America, the real, the, you know, and we've been hearing that rhetoric on the right for a long time, that the heartland is the real America, and somehow coastal cities that are full of people of color and immigrants and more progressive politics are somehow not real America. But that really, that logic has really deepened to this, I think, this idea that they really, I think there's a fundamental belief by a lot of these folks that that they need to protect the electorate, which they think of as like the true America, and that that is not the entire nation. And I think, you know, when you see some of this language of like Antifa, it was really interesting. If you listen to Trump's speech during the Mount Rushmore speech during the 4th of July, it was not a speech just against like BLM. That was some of the language, but it was really this anxiety actually about other kind of voters, like his, the obsession with Antifa. It's this idea of a multiracial coalition of Americans who are animated by a politics that's against white supremacy, that I think is seen as sort of an affront to this notion of sort of a certain kind of white democracy that's under threat. And I think you really see that they think they are protecting the electorate, because they are protecting it, because they have a certain conception of what constitutes a legitimate American. And a lot of us aren't part of that equation.
Let's take it back to migrants. The subtitle of your book, How Migrant Suffering Sustains White Democracy, is important, especially I want to bring it back to the fact that you said there was a time when Jim Crow racism was a bipartisan affair. Today, we see President Joe Biden being scrutinized for policies that are leading to huge numbers of unaccompanied minors trying to get across the U.S. border because families aren't allowed in still, and there are thousands of young people being held in terrible conditions. It is to the advantage, even political advantage, of Democrats to be compassionate. And of course, there's challenges to all of that. How do you view the modern Democratic Party's approach to immigration within the historic arc of how we've treated immigrants?
Yeah, it's a real challenge, because just as white supremacy for a very long time, and you know, you could say even to this day, but I think that the two parties have really veered off, and one side deciding to be part of to try to forge a more multiracial coalition, and the other side wanting diverse voters, but not wanting that kind of multiracial collective rule. I think there is a real divide there, but I think one thing you do see around immigration is that bad immigration policy has been a bipartisan affair, right? We've seen some of the worst policies towards immigrants happened under Bill Clinton. 1996 Welfare Act denied things like food stamps and Medicaid to legal immigrants. That was one of the first laws that began denying legal immigrants welfare state resources. And we saw with the Obama administration, which Joe Biden was a part of, they had their own occasionally very quite violent practices that they didn't crow about. But there was this feeling that I think that there was a different kind of initial approach until 2012, when migrant activists really shifted the conversation, and they got the dream, you know, and they got policies that began to transform that in terms of DACA, et cetera, right? But I think that, and the idea that we could sort of actually support Dreamers, but that was something that was pushed by migrant activists that didn't come from the Democratic Party establishment. So the Democratic Party has struggled with how, in part because they know this is such a passionate issue for a segment of voters, this anxiety. And so I think that the Democratic Party has been sort of, you know, participating in some of the uglier practices of anti-immigrant policies, and then trying to do something better. And so I think the task now is to figure out a sane and sensible, you know, discussion about the movement, the movement of people as something that is normal and natural, and sort of thinking about how do we think about the movement of people in the context of crisis, in the context of refugee politics, in the context of economics. And I think that the Democratic Party continues to struggle with this question of trying to perform certain notions of sovereignty that can be very violent towards people, while also assuaging anxieties of citizens. And I think a lot of this has to do with our own crisis in citizenship. It's like, what does citizenship actually mean? What does it, you know, I think one thing that Trumpism was very good at was not so much making citizenship a valuable category, but only making it valuable because it could be denied to others. right? So your citizenship was meaningful because violence could be enacted on non-citizens. So it didn't make our citizenship richer or more participatory or more, you know, beneficial to citizens. It was simply the pleasure of knowing that those people have even less and are subject to more degradation and deprivation. And so that makes my citizenship meaningful.
It sort of reminds me of the whole debate around same-sex marriage and how allowing same-sex couples to wed was somehow going to degrade the quality of heterosexual marriages and vice versa.
White supremacy is the politics of whiteness is a scarcity logic, right? It is, like you said, it's a zero-sum logic that says there's not enough, you know, of the benefits of citizenship or the benefits that the only way that this can work is if some people are denied, and then it makes me feel freer that you don't have it, as opposed to a politics that we could all, you know, live in safety and security and in a condition of justice. Yeah.
Well, Christina, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Is there a website where people can find out more about your work?
You can go to my website, is thetroublewithunity.com. It's named after my first book. There's information there. But thank you so much for having
me.
Thank you. Hopefully we're in a better moment today. I'm thinking we're going somewhere positive.
Thank you so much, Christina. Again, that website is thetroublewithunity.com. My guest has been Christina Beltran, Associate Professor, New York University's Department of Social and Cultural Analysis. Her earlier book was The Trouble with Unity, Latino Politics and the Creation of Identity. We've just been talking about her latest book, Cruelty as Citizenship, How Migrant Suffering Sustains White Democracy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.